You're listening to the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 35, recorded Saturday, 28th of April 2012. Tap caps. Alice Ning discusses the ins and outs of having a Kickstarter campaign for physical products versus software. We'll learn a bit about the magic behind capacitive touchscreens, and we learn what goes on behind the scenes of the TapCaps Kickstarter campaign. But first, a couple of news. The big news this week, of course, have been the record sales of WWDC 2012 tickets. Most of the people at the US West Coast missed out on tickets because the rush was over in just 2 hours compared to 12 hours last year. This year Apple tried something new. Individuals could only purchase one ticket and company accounts could only purchase 5. Non-transferable, no refunds. Unfortunately, the system to detect scalpers was a bit overzealous. Several people who used the same credit card and same IP address but different developer accounts received a cancellation notice from Apple. The problem with starting too early was that some people tried to purchase multiple individual tickets like this because at the time they couldn't get hold of the company account agent. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that Apple can work this out. It's a bit of an embarrassing situation. Apple, as usual, tried an engineering approach with technology to solve the problem of scalping, but then stumbling over a stupid bug. Apple obviously wanted to time the availability of tickets such that it's early morning in the US, evening in Europe, and before midnight in the Far East. But what even surprised them was the speed at which the tickets went. Probably helped along very much by the WWDC alert system that sent out messages to over 9,000 people. I received my own such message about 10 minutes after the beginning of the sales, that was 2:40 p.m. Central European time. There were several people not so lucky, as SMS are known to be unreliable at times. Some received the notifications never or simply too late. Now 2 hours is still twice as long as Google I.O. But hey, people get free hardware there. I think we can attribute the breaking of last year's record mostly to Twitter and the alert system. I got lucky myself as well. I had my phone on silent, so I totally missed the starting bell. But fortunately for me, some nice chap sent me a direct message on Twitter, which only further solidifies my theory that when people organize over social networks, they will break any record. Some other items before we get to the interview. A pro tip by Cedric Luthi. You must use my image at 2x-iPad.png, not my image -iPad at 2x.png when using the automatic process of image named. You know, image named can automatically give you the at 2x version on iOS devices with a Retina display. But did you know that it can also give you automatically a different image for iPhones and iPads? Yes, it does. You just call image named at myimage.png, and if there is a tilde iPad between the 2x and extension on the file system, then this will be returned on iPads. But the order matters. It's name at 2x tilde device extension. Remember this. Shortly after being acquired by Facebook, Instagram has opened up and nicely documented the API. You have an UL scheme to open Instagram from your own app, as well as web-based APIs to add and delete objects. In theory, you could build your own Instagram client with that. Any takers? You probably won't be purchased by Facebook though. Peter Steinberger reminds us, if Xcode 4.4 creates an entitlement with NS file protection complete and your app fails to start up, just delete it. Stuff isn't ready yet. And he references a developer forum thread discussing this. Well, you shouldn't be using Xcode 4.4 in production environments yet, making production apps with, but that doesn't prevent many individuals from doing exactly that. This is apparently already in iOS 5, as the mentioned thread is in the core OS iOS 5 beta archive, no longer under NDA. So I can mention the official response from an Apple engineer. One of my colleagues here in DTS discussed this issue with iOS engineering, and the conclusion was that this stuff does not currently work. App review weather. Both new apps and app updates have improved to 99% chance of being reviewed in under 5 business days. It's the first time I actually see both numbers to be on 99%. Makes me wonder if there is actually ever going to be a 3-digit number there. 100%. And that's it for the news. Today I've got a special guest with me. Her name is Alice Ning. She's from Washington, D.C., where she works as a management consultant by day and is an inventor by night. And I invited her on the show because she's got a Kickstarter campaign running at this time that we are recording now. And it's somewhat related to iPhone. The story behind it, let me give you that background as well. Some time ago, I wrote a blog post because I had a funny story with the lady that comes to our house to give us pedicures. And when we chatted, she told me, well, I can never get an iPhone because those don't work with these latex gloves. And she showed me a pair of latex gloves that she was using. And so with my natural curiosity, I tried it out, took these gloves and found it's actually no problem working an iPhone with that. And based on this, I tweeted and got many of my followers to also send in pictures where they were handling their iPhone with motorcycle gloves and various kinds of gloves. And I also tried a couple of my own that I would find in the house, like wool wouldn't work at all, but something that's maybe rubbery, like latex or maybe cleaning gloves would more or less work. But I stopped basically short of trying to research specialty gloves which are out there that you would buy to go skiing and still be able to use your iPhone or something like that. And Alice, who I have with me here, has actually invented a sort of sticker, if I may say, that you can affix to any kind of glove that you might have at home and basically give it touch capability. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Oliver.
So, Alice, give us a little bit of background. Where do you come from and what prompted you to invent such a cool thing?
Well, I basically come from the northeastern kind of portion of the United States where we experience all four seasons, which includes a pretty cold winter. And I also love to snowboard, so I find myself often wearing gloves. I've always liked to invent things. I love everything STEAM, which is what we were chatting. That is science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics.
Yeah, cool. I need to write that down. So that's science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics.
Correct.
Cool. STEAM. Okay. Never heard that before. So tell me more about that.
So I love everything STEAM, and it's something that I'm always reading and researching, self-learning about anyhow. And I think that having the arts in the STEAM, inside the STEM, actually, STEM is a pretty common term in the United States, which really was a result of Apple, the popularity of Apple, making this obvious comparison and relationship between the sciences and the arts.
Yeah, Steve Jobs was on stage when he was the last time and had this slide up where it says Apple being at the crossroads between liberal arts and science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. And so I think STEAM sums that up. But I've always been interested in that. So I'm always just kind of tinkering at night and on the weekends myself anyhow. And I greatly believe in just kind of improving on whatever you see or think can be improved up upon. I think, especially nowadays, most of us have just the resources at our fingertips. I guess that was an unintentional pun, but the resources at our fingertips to basically find this education ourselves. And so the first time actually that I had to operate my iPhone with gloves on, which was the first winter when I had an iPhone, I thought my phone was broken, actually. I was completely shocked that I couldn't use it while wearing my like wool gloves. And then later I found out that that's just a limitation of the capacitive touchscreen, that it needs to make direct contact with your skin because it feeds off of the human body's capacitance. And so I couldn't believe it because the iPhone is just so advanced and it's so seamless, yet all of that power was negated by just a little bit of cloth. So I just, didn't want to accept that as, something I'd have to do every winter. So I just started researching capacitive touchscreens, the whole process of how it works, specifically the iPhone capacitive touchscreens, because they happen to be the most sophisticated. They use definitely the most sophisticated technology.
Yeah, I think it doesn't Apple hold a patent on that and license it even to Android phones for because it's the best technology, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely the best technology right now, and they're very secretive about everything that they do. So who actually, makes their touchscreens, or how they acquired all the different technologies to be able to make this final sophisticated one. But I can tell that they're always improving on their touchscreen as well, because as I've tested my invention across like the iPhone 3G and then the 3GS and the 4, the 4S, and then all of these subsequent OS upgrades, there's actually differences in the way that it responds. I think so in general, it is just the most sophisticated touchscreen. So I primarily tested with the iPhone because I knew that anything that worked with the iPhone would work with all the rest of
Yeah,
them.
well, we don't care about those others. But tell me one thing, being a layman, I only heard the term capacitive several times, but I still have no idea what this is about. Could you maybe sum it up in one or two sentences for us lay people, how that actually works?
Sure. So,
Capacitive.
capacitance is the general term used in, I guess you could say physics, and basically it's the general term for the ability of an object or a mass to contain and control and hold electricity. And so, even in this day and age of very, very advanced technology, it surprised me that to find that electricity is actually not entirely understood even today. So there's many rules, and there's a lot of knowledge around electricity, but there's also a lot of unexplained phenomenon in electricity, and it's something that people are still working on today to try to understand. So capacitance is basically the terminology for anything that can hold electricity.
So
And the human
you mean hold like in you have a charge in it, like if I stroke a cat with something rubbery and I've got static electricity, that's the kind of charge you're talking about, or is it something different?
Yeah, it's basically that the like shocks and things like that happen for various reasons, but the human body has the thing called body capacitance, which means that the human body holds in itself a certain degree of electric charge, and this varies depending on how much body mass you have, how dehydrated or how much moisture or water you have in your body at the time. Sometimes altitude and also the environment affect that. And so the human body actually typically has a capacitance of like a certain measurement. So technically is between a certain range. And this is what distributes, basically through your fingertip that you're able to pass this capacitance onto the surface of your iPhone. And what Apple has been able to do is basically create a touchscreen that measures, exactly what the typical range of capacitance for the human body would be. And so what they've tried to do continuously is in their touchscreen, you know, be able to read a fingertip, but cancel out, for instance, your cheek. So if you're talking on your phone and then your cheek happens to, you know, touch the phone, it won't hang up your phone. Or it'll cancel out, you know, too much, you know, let's say, you know, like a, your entire palm kind of just touches the phone. It'll cancel that out, but it will still read intentional input.
So sort of the electrons that are in the tip of my finger, they travel through the screen to this detector grid.
Mm-hmm.
Like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. And it's always reading at that level. And, yeah, so it's actually a really amazing technology, the touchscreen, because it reads multiple different inputs. It can tell when you're using, you know, multiple different fingers to zoom in or to play a game, yet it cancels out everything that's unintentional. You know, like if it touches against your body when it's in your pocket or, any of that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, the iPhone can detect 5 points and the iPad 11, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So that's amazing technology there. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to seem that I'm pushing you to explain all your secrets, but wouldn't it just require making something that has the capacitance of human skin, like a piece of plastic or so? Or is there something more secretive and magical involved in your invention?
So it actually turns out that for instance, the exact amount of capacitance that the human finger is able to transmit, that's something that is rooted in an entire body. So for instance, when I first started researching this, a number of experts I talked to said that, you know, absolutely, there was absolutely no way to be able to mimic the measurement of human, you know, body capacitance in such a small device. So for instance, you know, the smallest you could ever get something to work would be like a larger stylus size, for instance, but definitely not something as thin and small, like a little oval sticker.
But and so, I got the several styluses, like one that we mentioned before, the one from Kickstarter. What was it again? The cosmonaut. So
mm-hmm.
Couldn't you just cut off the tip of that? Wouldn't that work?
No. So it actually wouldn't work. So it's since the amount of electricity that you would have to be able to contain in any object in order to operate the iPhone needs to, you know, equal the amount in the human body. But that's an impossible amount to be able to contain in such a small thing. It's I'm trying to think of the best way to explain it. Basically, something it's not so much the actual, you know, item or the size of what you're using. It's more so a combination of the materials and how they're created in such a way that they can properly pull that amount of electricity from the environment around it. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
It's not just the tip of one of those styluses, but it's also the mass that it has that is required.
Right. So in terms of the cosmonaut, they specifically are using, so for instance, their materials are very exact. They use an inner core of aluminum, and aluminum is extremely, it has a high capacitance. Like it's able to hold basically most metals are able to hold, you know, some electric charge. So it's good for that. And then the outside rubber that it's made of is also a special type of rubber that it's conductive enough so that it can transfer the capacitance from the aluminum core to the outside of the stylus, mm-hmm. but at the same time protects it and does not insulate it. It's kind of funny because rubber is commonly thought of to be, you know, an insulator, but and it usually is, but there's also, you know, advanced rubbers that are conductive as well. Mm-hmm. So so it has to be created in such a way. It's a surprisingly complicated process to get to such a simple end result, because so many factors can vary. So for instance, I can give you some good examples. As I was testing, I've tested just like tons and tons of different materials and materials created in such a way and put together in such a way that they can also, maximize the amount of capacitance that it takes from the environment. And there would be items that, devices that I would test, and then they would, be working on everything. And then all of a sudden, a day later, they would stop working. And then a day later, they would start working again. So it's just basically one of those electrical phenomenons that I was talking about, surprisingly still exists and isn't, not very well understood, but is something that, I observed time and time again and was able to figure out ways around.
So you've got a solution for this problem. It's not that you have to have a different sticker for each day of the week.
No, yeah.
if it doesn't work, then take the one for Wednesday.
Yeah.
So it's not just some sticker, but it's actually some sort of mini capacitance battery or something that you built there.
Yeah, basically. So the outside layer is really just protective, and then the inside layer is what's active, and that's basically a number of different special materials that when put together in the exact way that they're put together, mm-hmm. happen to be able to pull the exact amount of electricity that it needs from the environment and control and direct it into the phone, mm-hmm. into the surface of the phone. Oh. Yeah, it's kind of, and it's interesting too, because even the tiniest variation makes it not work, and then it's not like you can follow logical, like point A goes to point B goes to point C. Mm. It's actually all a system of trial and error.
But you're not saying that this risk is one that the people who help fund your campaign are bearing? Or are you saying it could be that you find that you cannot come up with a design that works 99.9% of the time?
Well, so far I've found a design that works 99.9% of the time. That's the final one that I came up with.
Oh, so you already have that?
One that works.
Okay.
So I have one that works and is reliable up to that point. And that's what, that's kind of in the Kickstarter video. I was talking, I've really emphasized that it's stable and reliable because I'd been through so many, tests where those were some of the things I was really trying to maximize. Mm-hmm. So I have that now, but I want to be able to get it to be even smaller and even, just more, I guess, pleasant to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we now know what it is. So you mm-hmm. developed some sort of magical thing that's small and fits into a sticker. And now, where does Kickstarter come in?
So Kickstarter, I've actually been watching and been, a follower of Kickstarter for the past year. And I was seeing more and more product design projects appear on Kickstarter, especially things that are very technology oriented. And people seem very, willing and eager and supportive of helping and, of like the DIY inventor, or the do-it-yourself type of inventor. So I thought that would be a great way to start. I've been so just deep in the actual research and design for so long. When I finally got to this final prototype that I was really proud of, I was just, excited about it. And I almost just didn't even know what to do with it at that point. Mm. So I thought that Kickstarter would be the best way to, number one, kind of do a soft launch where it was now known and out in the public. Number two, to gauge the interest and to also get additional feedback. That's one thing that I've been really appreciative of. Mm-hmm. People will send comments and emails, asking about, for instance, what other colors and will be available, or that they think that it should come in a pack of, four or 10 or, things like that. So I'm getting a lot of feedback, which is helping me with the business side of things. And then also just having something that's been distributed enough to be able to gauge investor and retailer interest as well.
So, can you summarize what is the aim of this first campaign? Because you said there's going to be more than just this one.
So far, my plan is to have a second one. This first one is to be able to raise enough funds to be able to basically use, have the ability to use, a professional studio and with all of the machinery and all the tools that I actually need to get this to be, an even more polished, smaller, pleasant device. So primarily the first pro the first this first campaign is to be able to get that access and create this final prototype, which will instantly be able to, with that, I'll be instantly able to get, meetings and be able to discuss with manufacturers in a more productive manner. And that's basically the function of this first project, though it's actually exceeding a lot of my expectations with the,
How so?
interest from, well, it's mostly the interest in from investors and distributors and retailers that I've been surprised about. And so I think that usually angel investors, they'll want to invest a much more, they want to invest more money for a bit of equity in the actual company and the invention and all of that type of stuff, which is something that I had considered but not really gotten around to truly thinking about. I was just kind of ready to, bootstrap and just muscle through this entire thing to get it to market. But then now with that additional, it looks as though I'll be able to get, everything done even faster and even better with this additional backing. So that's been really great to see.
So far, there's this site, Kick Track, where you can see the amount that projects are trending to, and this says that you're going to end up with 15,000. And so you it looks like you will do slightly more than your funding goal, and so this will probably be successful. Now, what's the volume that you then will have in the second round, you think?
Depending, I think that it will be something larger, like something like 50,000 for entire first marketing manufacturing run. It'll be run very similarly, I think, to the Cosmonaut project or that Coffee Julie's project, where that first amount basically allows for an entire manufacturing run, which will include, being able to get to market and be able to distribute the final sets to basically everyone who is in line to have them. So everyone from this campaign, everyone from the next campaign, as well as all the initial orders. So I think it'll be something with a slightly bigger goal, but I expect it, especially since it'll launch closer to as the weather is cooling down. But I expect it to, achieve that and hopefully exceed it.
Yeah, didn't you get some feedback from people that it's now a little bit hot to be thinking about winter gloves and touch screens?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the timing of this campaign didn't quite I think in terms of, you're going to look at it in terms of marketing and public relations and that type of aspect, it probably isn't the best time to launch, just given that it's not something that's heavily on anyone's minds, especially since in the States we had a very mild winter this past year.
Yeah, global warming, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So, actually, most of the interest has come from Scandinavia and like right around where you are, Northern Europe. So it's pretty interesting, but that's definitely been some of the feedback, and so I think that when it launches closer to the winter, people will be, thinking about it a bit more.
So a comparison to, say, the Glyph or the Cosmonaut is a bit unfair, it seems to me, because those guys had finished and fully designed prototypes, and they were just looking to get sort of the initial production run funded. Whereas with you and your first campaign, we are actually ground floor. It's still research and development, right?
Yeah, you could say that. It would be classified as R&D, though technically the R&D is mostly complete. So it's just because the research that I've done so far with manufacturers, I found that you have to be extremely specific mm-hmm. when working with the manufacturers. And they also, you know, they do business in such large quantities that they're very unwilling to work with, you know, a new product if they can't physically see exactly what you want them to create. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the reason that I need this first campaign to, you know, to have that, to be able to then have a better ability to discuss with the manufacturers. And so with it would be the second Kickstarter campaign that would be comparable to, you know, the Glyph or the Cosmonaut.
Yeah. So what did actually prompt you to try Kickstarter? Is there a story behind that?
Well, when I first started noticing Kickstarter, it was because there were just so many interesting projects on there, and people were sending me, you know, just links to certain things. And no, since it's something that I've always done as well, I've always kind of just invented, and I always have these ideas of things that I'll research and I'll, you know, create some homemade prototype, but I just don't know how to get from that homemade prototype to being something that could be in the market. Mm-hmm. It's one of, you know, I think it's just one of those dreams that I've always kind of had and didn't really know what the next step would be. And so with Kickstarter, it's been such an amazing thing because I've seen so many of these people who are just like me, who have these dreams and, you know, work at night or actually be funded and actually get that initial start that they need. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what prompted me. I figure with Kickstarter, you have absolutely nothing to lose. Even if the
so
project is...
Mm-hmm. Who is the you? You, nothing to
lose,
the people who are pledging or the people who are doing the campaigns or both?
I would say both. The people who are doing the campaigns have absolutely nothing to lose. In fact, even if a project is unsuccessful, it people are so, I think, vocal with their opinions that you are able to get a lot of good feedback that you can then use, you know, to either improve the product or to improve other things that you might work on. And then the people who pledge, Kickstarter has a lot of just safeties kind of built in there for the pledgers. Mm-hmm. If the project is unsuccessful as a whole, then, you know, nobody's pledges are actually taken. If the campaigner or the person with the project is unable to deliver on any of the rewards, Kickstarter requires that you cancel your project mm-hmm. and refund their pledges. So there's very little risk involved, I'd say, from both sides. Mm-hmm.
There was this one campaign that I pledged to recently, where one of the updates was that the CEO told us, I'm sorry, I mismanaged all the funds and I'm now $200,000 in the debt, and I tried to talk to additional venture capitalists to get some funding going. But you're saying basically if he doesn't get it together, Kickstarter would force him to return the funds.
I can't speak for Kickstarter, so I'm not sure what to what degree they would act. Hmm. But it is one thing that you know, in their terms and conditions, when you launch a Kickstarter project, that's one of the line items that they expect that, you know, the project person will absolutely uphold all of their commitments. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I take that very, very seriously.
I believe so. I believe you. now, recently we have seen more and more campaigns that are not doing physical goods like some product that you eventually will be able to buy in a store, but there are software and games trying to get funding. So what's your opinion about this? Because personally, I have mixed feelings. I've obviously, there was this Double Fine Adventure, which broke mm-hmm. one record until, which was $3.3 million, until that got bested by the Pebble, which is now, I think, at 5 million or so. So do you have any opinion regarding what kind of products? Or do you say, okay, whenever people want to pledge for it, that's okay and it's all fine? But just one sentence, then I let you give your response. Don't you think that too many shady projects would distract people from the few that are really innovative and serious?
Okay, those are all good points. So I would say my opinion is that I can certainly see the advantage for someone who's creating a software or something that is intangible to go on to Kickstarter. In fact, I think that probably should be the first thing that they do, because they absolutely have nothing to lose. There's no true distribution costs. So for instance, with an actual product like, with TapCaps, I've realized that I have to factor in shipping costs mm-hmm. to each of the people. And so there's just a number of other overhead issues. So people who are developing intangible items really don't have those overhead issues as much. So it's something that I would almost think that everyone should do. At the same time, it's interesting because it's true what you say, there could be more, or at least people who might mismanage funds or have, kind of half-baked type of projects could more easily put things on Kickstarter. And I'm sure that that's something that Kickstarter is trying to mitigate and, trying to stay ahead of right now. I haven't personally seen anything. I've heard that there have been some campaigns that have been, very disappointing. But then I think the vast majority have delivered on what they've said that they would deliver. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say. But I think that the advantage definitely lies with people who have intangible goods or services as part of their projects. Because, for instance, in the rewards, they can even easily issue, memberships to people who pledge a certain amount, or e-downloads, which is just such an easy distribution method. They also have a never-ending, once they get over the initial development phase, they have this, never-ending product mm-hmm. and never-ending supply. Whereas for me, I can only create a certain amount, and then I'll have to create, an additional amount batch.
But then hopefully the first manufacturing run then will probably go out entirely to the people who back it, right? Mm-hmm. But hopefully you will then have everything set up and be able to have another run and another run and be able to sell these then via regular channels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the goal is to basically have a firm understanding of how many I need in this first run mm-hmm. to be able to, produce the maximum number that I would think that, I could sell or that people would want in that first round. Mm-hmm. So instantly it would cover all the Kickstarter backers in addition to, my first customers.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's over, we have like 1 week left or so for your mm-hmm. campaign. Is there anything that you think now, you would do differently if you started the campaign again?
I definitely have learned a lot, I would say. I probably would have figured out some type of PR campaign before launching mm-hmm. And have sent out, all the adequate press releases and, kind of created that much of a pre-buzz before actually launching to get everything off to a start. I've noticed that, and rather organically, but have a Kickstarter campaign in itself is actually kind of like having a full-time job. There's a lot to follow up on, and there's a lot of, kind of getting the word out there yourself. And so I've noticed that every time I've been successful in, you know, being featured somewhere that, you know, great, it directly impacts the success of the Kickstarter campaign. And then at the same time, people are more willing to pledge, or they have more confidence in the campaign if it's doing, you know, what it's supposed to, if it's either ahead of what it should be doing at that point in time, or if it's, you know, estimated to succeed. So I think if starting out very, very strong is certainly the way to go with a Kickstarter campaign, having everything ready to launch in terms of, you know, interviews or features, having contacted, you know, many, many people, having friends or people lined up who want to pledge and are ready to pledge that first day, because having an initially successful run, you know, in the first week impacts, I think, what will happen in the end. So it was actually just pure luck, actually, that someone from Gizmag saw my campaign on Kickstarter during that. It was like towards the end of that first week, and then featured it on Gizmag, which then got featured on Mashable, which then, you know, kind of just went down the line. And that you can see in your Kickstarter dashboard where the, you know, pledges and the referrals come in from. And so many have come in from both of those sources that I've realized, you know, PR, there definitely isn't, you know, enough that could be said for a proper PR. So that's something I would definitely have done more of in the beginning.
Have a professionally produced video, have all the rewards kind of thought out, and do all the psychological things that go into that. Like, for example, one thing that I've seen some do is that they have one level, and then they find if they just add one little thing to this level and make it, instead of $100, $150, then you will have many people who will upgrade their pledge and thus lift it over the final goal amount. So things like
that's
this,
true.
You have to plan in advance, right?
Yeah, that's true. And then even just having, for instance, after the first 2 days, I got enough responses asking for a $100 pledge level that I actually created one, and then basically, you know, was trying to figure out what I could give for them. So then I basically designed, you know, a unique t-shirt and all of that type of stuff. So there's definitely a lot of fun rewards that you can do, and that helps a lot. I just, part of me actually hates sales and kind of asking for pledges. So that's one reason why I was initially unwilling to like really strategize a lot about the reward levels, because I like, you know, things that are simple, and having just very solid, obvious rewards for, you know, an obvious kind of pledge. And, you know, I didn't want to constantly bother people to pledge if, you know, if they chose and they didn't want to. But I've actually found that it's the backers, all of my backers are so supportive, and they're actually very excited about it. Every time I send out an update, I get a lot of feedback. And so I've realized that there's more to it than just asking for support. It's it's kind of creating community and excitement around your invention.
Well, I found the first few projects that I backed, that it was always a calculation going on in my head that was like, okay, if I were to buy this in a store, it would cost me $30 maybe. Okay, that's the amount that I am going to pledge. But later projects are more or less tricking me into going much higher than that. Like, for example, on the Double Fine Adventure, I would have gotten the game for, I think, like $30. But okay, I also wanted to have the signed poster and all the other goodies, so I ended up with $150, which is five times as much. And I think lately it's those projects that really kind of get people from just basically pre-ordering a product and paying for one product to actually spending much more money on that. And you told me before you have people who are who have chosen a certain pledge level, but actually send you more money than that.
Yeah, and I think in those cases they're just people who, I mean, I'm almost just, you know, shocked by this myself, because technically it doesn't make any, you know, like financial sense. But what they're doing is they're just such lovers of invention and innovation, and especially I think do-it-yourself type of innovation. That they're, you know, they're just so supportive and just so encouraging. And I think it's true when you think about it that without this type of innovation, you would only have large companies doing it, and you would, I mean, the entire, all like Silicon Valley wouldn't exist. So there has to be someone out there to support it in order for this to continue. So I can see, you know, just needing that initial push.
Do you see yourself moving to Silicon Valley?
I could, certainly. I mean, I love that area. The whole Bay Area is just absolutely beautiful. So I could definitely see that. Right now, because I work full-time here, and I'm also completely self-funded, I'm happy in Washington, D.C., but I do tend to move around a lot. I've lived in lots of different countries and all around the states, and I would love to live in San Francisco or that area.
Isn't that where the money is for technology, invention, engineering, and so on?
That's where a lot of the money. Well, yeah, that's where a lot of the money is. But surprisingly, DC actually has a very large venture capital community, and there's a lot of tech and innovation here as well. So I've been recently networking a lot here and going to many events. There's a group called Tech Cocktail, and there's Startup DC, and Fosterly, which is also a local local community kind of organization. So there is actually a lot here, which I've been surprised about. And it's almost a smaller community, whereas in Silicon Valley, everyone does this. Like, everyone has a startup on the side that you have just almost no competitive advantage, and there's almost too much, you know, that you need to filter. Whereas here in DC, it's less common. It's a smaller community. Therefore, there's more of an ability to actually make the connections that you need and kind of have, you know, the mentorship that you might need.
Is it fair to say that Silicon Valley is more about software these days, as opposed to what the name actually says, the valley where silicon plays a role?
I think it's very, very heavily tech and software, but I do see still a lot of gadgets and things like that that come from there. So I think they're still pretty forward thinking and still very much so the leaders in everything software and hardware, so like tangible and intangible. There's definitely a lot of creativity out there, and I think that's what really fuels it.
All right. I think we've chatted very long already. It's already 42 minutes. I'm out of questions. Can you maybe at the end give our listeners kind of an action? What should they do now? Obviously, go to the Kickstarter page. But the stage is yours. What do you want to say to them?
Well, I would say thank you very much for listening. I hope you take a moment to check out my project on Kickstarter and follow and look out for the additional one as well. I will certainly keep everyone updated, as well as on my webpage for the product, which is thetapcaps.com. But really, you know, thank you very much for being people who even are interested in any of this innovation, whether it be software or hardware in general. I think that all of this interest and all of this support is what's needed to continue it to grow and, you know, to continue progressing. And it's amazing too that all of these people are, you know, that your audience is from all around the world. So that's just pretty amazing as well.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Alice, for taking so long to answer all my questions and be on the show and be a nice person all around. I encourage everyone, as you said, go to the Kickstarter page, Pledge. It's an amazing product. And if you have any kind of situation where the weather dips to a level where you need gloves, but you still want to use your iPhone that you love so much, here's the product for you. And it's very cheap and very effective if you just invest for, say, the $50 levels or the $100 levels, because you get two stickers there when they come off the production run. And that's what I did as well. So that's another episode of the Coconetics podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for interest. And I'll be seeing you next week when we do this again.